podcast is brought to you by
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The days of the cowboy may be long gone, but their memory still lives on in the smooth taste of a Red Apple cigarette. The Red Apple Tobacco Company has been manufacturing the best-tasting tobacco products since 1862. Whether you buy them in a pouch, a carton, or a pack, with Red Apple's flavor guarantee, we've always got your back. So if you're looking for the best drag with the best tobacco flavor with less burn on your throat than any other non-filter cigarette, then you're looking for a Red Apple cigarette. So go on, take a bite. And feel all right. Take a bite of a Red Apple.
Here we go.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Need you cool. Are you cool?
I'm cool.
Are you gonna bark all day, little doggy, or are you gonna bite?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration? Renishi! Shobuwa
Maratsu China! Ready to fly, bitch!
I'm a killer. I'm a murdering bastard, you know that? And there are consequences to breaking the heart of a murdering bastard.
You really only need to hang mean bastards. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
You hear me talking, hillbilly boy? I'ma get medieval on your ass.
You're the shot for this?
Nah, I don't think so. More like chewed out. I've been chewed out before.
Hey, is everybody okay?
The fucking hippies aren't. That's for goddamn sure.
Kill white folks and they pay you for it. It's nothing like
starting to see pictures, ain't you?
Well, gentlemen, you have my curiosity. Now you have my attention.
Welcome all you inglorious bastards to another edition of Pulp Reflections, the monthly series dedicated to taking a retrospective look back at Pulp Fiction as it turns 30. I am your host, the Reverend Scott Kate, and on this month's episode, aptly titled, That's Some Gourmet Pulp, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the world-building Pulp Fiction did to help create what we now know as the Tarantinoverse, and to see what connections this film has had to others within it. Joining me for this discussion is a newcomer to the show. He's a film reviewer for the Top 10 Films website, a former senior editor for FilmWatt, and former radio host of Film Talk on Swellcast Radio. It's Mr. Neil Damiano. Welcome, Mr. Damiano, and may Tarantino be with you always.
Thank you. I'm super excited about being on here finally. I know we've been in talks, and I'm ready to shoot the shit about Tarantino, man.
Well, it's good to have a fellow New Yorker on here, except you're a New Yorker. I'm an upstate New Yorker, so we're not the same. I know.
Yeah.
I know we're not.
I mean, I'm in Connecticut, but close enough, and you know, I get told I sound like I'm from New York. I have a New York accent.
You could tell everyone you are. No one's going to know.
Yeah.
You know.
But, you know.
Yeah.
Close enough to New
exactly.
York.
Now, you have done a lot, and we kind of discussed a little bit before we started recording. So why don't you give us, all my listeners, a little insight of what you used to do and what you currently are doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been involved with film for probably 25-plus years. I went to school for film and media studies. And then when I got out, I volunteered for a lot of local film festivals in Connecticut, local ones. And then I decided to apply for Tribeca on a lark and ended up getting a volunteer position there for a year. And then they liked what I had, the way I was performing there. So they hired me my second year, and I worked there for 3 years on staff, anywhere from press screenings to the press department. Had a fantastic time there. That was an amazing experience. And then from there, I worked at IFC for 2 years as a programming consultant for the horror division, IFC Midnight. So like films like ATM and mm-hmm. kind of those cheesy horror films. I had a say in the green lighting of them airing. So that was fun. And been guests on several podcasts, film podcasts. And then I had my own show on Swellcast Radio for a little while called Film Talk until they changed their format, and had a lot of viewers, and basically would talk about comedies, horror films, dramas, thrillers, all sorts of types of films. I've been writing for Top 10 Films website out of England since 2012,
oh, wow,
doing articles and Top 10 film lists. And that site, I gotta tell you, it's a really fun site for film fanatics, you know, because you can literally type in anything and you'll get like a Top 10 Films list written by somebody, the contributors. So I've done probably close to 100 Top 10 lists for them.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So was pretty prolific on there, and quite a lot of articles. But it's a really fun site. I recommend it. I mean, I'll give the address after if you want.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, you know, I've been floating around the film world for quite some time.
You know? That's pretty impressive.
So
you're pretty well-versed in it.
Yeah. I've loved film since I was a kid, and spent most of my time as a child. I played outside too, but I was inside watching a lot of movies, probably movies that I shouldn't have been, you know, at a young age. But mom was pretty liberal with film, and she's a film fan too. So, you know, I watch movies with her, but, you know, all those teen movies and slasher films, I just, I gravitated towards. So yeah, I mean, it's been fun. I've gotten to do some pretty cool stuff.
Now, where does Tarantino fall into your life, and where do you hold him in regards as a filmmaker?
Well, I first caught wind of Tarantino. I read an article in a film magazine on Reservoir Dogs back in 1991, where it was just catching, like there was a little bit of a buzz on it. And then it came out in 1992 on VOD. That's when I saw it. But I can't remember what magazine. It might have been like one of the older ones, like Premiere. Mm-hmm. That's no longer in, you know, publication. But and I was like, you know, this sounds like a movie I would like. And then, you know, towards the end of 1991 and a couple months later, there was all sorts of commercials about this new bank heist film called Reservoir Dogs with a strange name on VOD. And it just caught a buzz. So, you know, I watched it and, man, I was hooked. I was floored. You know, I was like, this is like right up my alley, man. Yeah. I just never seen anything that like fascinating as far as a film. It was so cutting edge. And then I just started, I was like, I got to check this guy Tarantino out. I just started getting books on him and, you know, really delving myself. At that time, I was really getting into film in around 91, 92. I was really getting really hardcore into film. And I was still in high school back then. So that's when I started like getting into reading on and checking out the independent films and that kind of stuff. He just came up on the radar and like just became hooked and couldn't wait till the next thing he was going to do. But I went out and bought the, you know, on VHS and you know, on the DVD, Reservoir Dogs, and I had a t-shirt and, you know, just was telling everybody about Tarantino, you know, and like, I remember telling my mom and she's like, oh, is that that guy who does the violent films? And I'm like, yeah, mom, but they're stylized, you know, they're not meaningless violence, you know, what I mean? A means to an end. But, you know, like Tarantino, I'm sure you've heard him in interviews say, you know, it's a part of life. It, you know, violence is a part of life. It's a major part of life as a human. So, you know, you remember that famous interview with that lady where she calls him out on the violence, which I go back and watch and I posted before. And I just think it's hilarious the way he puts her into place when he has, he's wearing the hockey jersey. So great interview.
Amazing interview.
It's pretty funny. But yeah, no, so that's, you know, where I just started getting into his Reservoir Dogs was my introduction.
Now, what is your personal connection to this film, Pulp Fiction? Where did you first see it? And what has been its lasting impression on you?
Well, I saw, I went to the theater to see, was excited, anticipating going to the theater to see it. When the trailer, you know, like when they were airing the trailers back then on TV. And I was like, wow, this looks really, like, creative, you know. I believe I went to the opening night at the Fourplex at the time, Guilford Fourplex. You know, was floored when I saw it. I was so stylized. And it was, you know, like, to me, Tarantino is probably the greatest postmodern filmmaker ever. I mean, he draws influences from a lot of directors, as you can see in his films. But, I mean, nobody does dialogue and pop culture retro references like Tarantino. He has created a style of his own. And, you know, that's the brilliance of Tarantino, is that, like, he's created literally a film genre. other director, you know what I mean? Like, I've seen DVDs where it says, you know, very Tarantino-esque, and that's a term now. Yeah. Meaning that it's going to have, you know, fast-cutting editing, flashy scenes, edgy, relatable, dragged dialogue, pop culture references from the past. And, you know, that's all going to be tried to be in the movie like Tarantino. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, like, I don't know if you're aware, but somebody got me the shirt, too. It's a funny, it has Tarantino's face on it, but they coined it the cinema of cool. That's Tarantino.
Yep.
Cinema of cool. And that's what, you know, his style is dubbed. You know, I mean, it's postmodern filmmaking. It's hip filmmaking. It's like if you were into, like, What's Happening, and you catch a What's Happening reference, which could very well happen in a Tarantino film. Mm-hmm. Because he's so fascinated by pop culture. That's, you know, Tarantino. That's what he does. And he does it brilliantly. And, you know, it's influenced other films, you know, after Pulp Fiction, I think influenced a lot of films. I think it changed the face of cinema. You know, there was nothing like that. I think there might have been another film where the ending started at the beginning type thing. But like, you know what I mean? Like he brought that out to the forefront. And then you had other films after that, like 2 Days in the Valley is very influenced by Pulp Fiction. You know,
Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Right. There's a whole slew of Tarantino-esque type film. I don't know if you've ever seen 68 Kill, but that's so much like a Tarantino film. It's a newer film, but it's a great film. And it pulls off a Tarantino style. It's because some of them don't. You know what I mean? Some
yes,
of them
I
try,
do.
But they just don't.
Yes.
But, you know, that one happened to very well. I recommend that to your viewers. 68 Kill.
68 really great Kill, film. All right.
So, I think it got ripped off for film of the, for Oscar film of the year. Of course, Forrest Gump's going to win because it's Spielberg-ish friendly.
Soft. It's desensitized. It's just, hey.
It's for the general audience. Pulp Fiction really is not, even though it's adored.
Yeah.
But, I think it changed the face of cinema at that point because it was the early 90s. Yep. And we were still on, like, kind of the Spielberg family-oriented films at that time. And then you have Tarantino comes out with, like, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, who really stylizes, you know, really puts violence to the forefront, needed violence. You know, and anything that he does, like, even the films that he was involved with, like Natural Born Killers and Killing Zoe, very Tarantino.
True Romance.
True Romance, right, which happens to be my favorite script from Tarantino.
I mean, really?
Yeah. Absolutely love that film.
All right, well, now it's time for your opening guest questions.
Let's ask our guest some fucking questions.
And this season, all guests, new or old, get the same five, and they're all Pulp Fiction related. And these are yours. Although they're not special, I do apologize. But your answers will be what's special about them.
Well, I can tell you right now, they're probably not going to be the majority answer of what you
Good. I like when people throw me some curveballs.
Number one.
So your first one is, who is your favorite character from Pulp Fiction?
Like right now. And it's not just because it's Quentin Tarantino. I just love the character Jimmy. I just think he's hilarious. For the little small part that he had in Pulp Fiction, that's so me. Like, the sarcasm just oozes out, man. Like, when I heard him say, like, I don't need you to tell me how fucking good my coffee is, okay? I'm the one who buys it.
Yeah.
You know, I know how good it is. When Bonnie goes shopping, she buys shit. When I heard that in the theater, I fucking laughed my ass off. It was so hilarious how he comes out with that, like duels. It hit the mark perfectly, and his delivery was like perfect. You know, the bathrobe he's wearing up in his hand. To me, just such a funny character. You know, he's not a major character in it, but just his part was just, you know, the sarcasm was glorious in it. You probably don't hear that often, but Jimmy.
Actually, you're maybe the second person I've heard say that. There's another person. I'm trying to make sure I get it correct. I think my buddy Elwood Jones has been on. I think he said Jimmy, but I could be wrong. Another person has said Jimmy. Yeah. So Jimmy has a little fan club out there. The Jimmy Dimmick fan club. And he may come up a little bit later in the show.
No.
Now, what is your favorite song from the film's amazing soundtrack?
A lot of them, but my favorite is Son of a Preacher Man. This is such a good song by Dusty's.
And I love the way it kicks in, too. Just the way we enter the Mia and Vincent moment. It's amazing.
That scene where Vega walks in and he gets the note directing, you know, and he goes in and she's directing him from the security room.
Yeah.
It's just such a great scene. And that song just kind of transitions in. Is just, it's chills.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Tarantino knows where to place a song.
Yes, he does.
He's worked all his own films, and he knows where to put them. And it just, breathtaking scene. It's just so good. And such a great song, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, yeah, that's my favorite.
Number three.
Now, what is your favorite line of dialogue or monologue from the film?
I just gave it to you, but I could do it again. I don't need you to tell me how fucking good my coffee is, okay? I'm the one who buys it. You know, that line. I know how good it is.
And it's a great line. You forget about it because there's so much going on in the film. And so many little, what you think are throwaway lines. Really, there's a lot of great choice lines.
The delivery in the moment and Jules' reaction and just like everything together for me just was funny as shit and so engaging. But there's so many great lines. And I mean, I'm sure Zed is dead. You know, bring out the Gimp.
Yeah.
The Zaya scene. Religion, you know, Jules and Royal, which she, you know, the whole film.
Like every 5 seconds, something is something. Look at the big brain on Brett. You a smart motherfucker. Like there's so many different lines you go through.
Yeah. And that's another thing that makes Pulp Fiction fantastic is just the dialogue.
Oh, so quotable. Yeah.
Number four.
Now, what is your favorite scene from Pulp Fiction? Or do we have a theme building here? Or is there something different?
No. My favorite scene is the adrenaline shot. Yeah. Absolutely love that. It's just such an intense scene. Everyone's acting in it is top notch.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Stoltz and Rosanna Arquette's arguing chemistry is divinely funny. You know, they're going back and forth and like a married old couple, and it's hilarious. and Eric Stoltz is this kind of laid back surfer dude where nothing really bothers him. And she's like a neurotic, nervous Nelly nutcase. And I've always loved Rosanna Arquette for several reasons. But when Vega goes ape shit, knowing that if Mia dies, the consequences, so he's flipping his lid, man. He's, you know.
And he drags poor Lance into it now, too. It's like, if she dies and I die, you're going to fucking die, you know?
And then the needle drops.
Yeah.
So it's a great scene.
And you're right. When she goes, that was fucking trippy, man. It's just such a great fucking scene.
And she looks crazy, Rosanna Arquette. They made her look so, such a beautiful woman. But
her emotional roller coaster in that scene is quite impressive. Quite impressive. She's pissed off that someone's waking up with a phone call. Then someone hits her house. But right before the moment, she gets very excited. Like when they do the close up of her face, right before we drop it. It's amazing. Yeah.
And, they made her look crazy, too. But that scene is just so intense, man.
Number five.
And our last question, what do you think is in Marcellus Wallace's briefcase?
Okay, I know there's been several discussions on this and
conspiracies
or theorists.
theory everywhere.
I think, or I want to believe, and this is where True Romance ties in, that it held Elvis's original gold shining suit.
Oh, I like that.
Because I think that's what Tarantino would do, just from studying him and knowing, he's an Elvis fanatic.
True, very true.
I just think that's the most Tarantino-esque thing to do, you know, and it ties in with True Romance when, Clarence is having the visions of Elvis being his guardian angel or kind of like his guiding, you know, God.
Yes.
And, you know, like to me, it would just fit, you know. I know I've seen in several interviews, Tarantino has left it to open interpretation.
I think he always will. I don't think there's anything, and I've said this many times, there's nothing that he can tell us it is that will quench our thirst for what we think it is. What you like, if you found that it was like, oh, it's a set of, it's the pussy wagon keys or something, so you'd be like, oh, you know what I mean?
Or
it's
going to
be a letdown. Yeah, it'll be a letdown because it's the great thing. It's our mind is left to interpret and then have these great discussions of what we discuss.
And diamonds is such a boring thing, but you know, it could be, and you know, it's such a predictable thing.
Yeah.
But I like to think outside the box and think it'd be funny if it was Elvis's original, you know, shining gold glitter suit from that he always wore, the king, you know. Because
there's only two people alive who have seen it now, because everyone else is dead. So I'm sure everyone in that apartment saw it.
But the only two people have seen it is Vincent. Well, he's dead now, too. So Vincent saw it. He's dead. And Pumpkin. Because even Honey Bunny says, God damn it, what is it? And Samuel L. Jackson's character, Jules, never looks in the case. He never looked in the case. He asked if we were good. And then he spun it and opened it. I mean, he obviously knew what was probably in it because he was probably told what we're finding. Yeah. But Jules never looks in the case. And there's only technically one living person outside of maybe now Marcellus who knows. And that was Pumpkin. He's the only other person who saw it. And who knows? Maybe he's dead, too. You never know.
Have you heard the crazy theorists that believe it was Marcellus Wallace's soul?
I have heard that many times.
On the back of his neck.
Yeah.
The 666 combination.
Yep.
That's pretty wild.
I like it. The only reason I push back on it, the only, it's the line of dialogue Pumpkin says when he says, is that what I think it is? So it's something that Pumpkin has seen before. So we would have to assume that Pumpkin has somehow seen someone's soul before. But in all honesty, if that is what someone enjoys, then, you know, by all means, it's fucking Marcellus's soul. I am not someone who's going to say that your fucking theory is wrong.
That's
because
a pretty wild fucking theory.
It's like one of the original theories, too. It was a good one, too. It's a good yeah. theory. And we may discuss that at, like, the last episode of this season for this. So.
Cinematic journey back through time to the iconic world of Pulp Fiction. Brace yourselves as we take a deep dive into the minutiae, the brilliance, and the unforgettable moments that define this cult classic. Welcome to Pulp Reflections. For this episode's discussion entitled That's Some Gourmet Pulp, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the world-building Pulp Fiction did to help create what we now know as the Tarantinoverse. So sit back, relax, and let the discussion begin.
Over the course of his 30-plus year career, Tarantino has crafted an interconnected on-screen mythology by introducing various fictional brands, products, places, and minor character crossovers between his films. For example, the cigarette brand Red Apple Tobacco often makes an appearance, while his fictitious brands like Red Apple Cigarettes, Old Chattanooga Beer, or Big Kahuna Burger help to create a consistent thread. Tarantino also likes to link stories through character names and relations. For instance, Vic Vega from Reservoir Dogs and Vincent Vega from Pulp Fiction are implied to be brothers, while the exhumed body of Paula Schultz in Kill Bill Volume 2 is hinted at possibly being the wife of Dr. King Schultz from Django Unchained. Tarantino's shared universe has no overarching narrative. Rather, the connections serve as fun Easter eggs for fans to discover. They imply that the films take place in the same reality, allowing Tarantino to make winking references to his own work. The fake brands as reoccurring props and set dressing throughout two centuries, with Bob rolling his own cigarette with Red Apple Tobacco in the late 1800s in The Hateful Eight, to the bride passing an advertisement for the cigarette brand in the early 2000s in the Tokyo airport in Kill Bill Volume 1. Overall, Tarantino has crafted a rich, albeit loose, tapestry of interconnected stories and characters across time through recurring details from fake brands to character bloodlines. The consistency ties the films together into one unique cinematic universe for audiences to explore. Mr. Damiano, does this self-contained universe add to your enjoyment of his films? And is there another director's cinematic universe that you also enjoy?
Well, I've had this discussion before and I've had people laughing about it. Is think about, you know, Kevin Smith does yes. this for New Jersey.
He does.
The same mm-hmm. thing. But Kevin Smith does it from a comedic standpoint. Mm. Tarantino does it from a more dramatic thriller standpoint or a violent standpoint. Mm-hmm. But they both do the same thing. Smith's college crowd, the view askew, like that whole mm-hmm. universe of, you know, Snoochie Boochies, the brands, RSK, you yeah. know, Quick Stop, all that stuff
yep.
Is total New Jersey. So they're very similar.
Agreed.
You know, they're very similar. So I love both universes. I am a fan of Kevin Smith too, proudly. And I think what he does is great for New Jersey and his kind of world with Chewy's gum and all this stuff that doesn't exist only in the view askew world of Smith. For same thing with Tarantino, like, you know, the Pussy Wagon and Red Apple and mm-hmm. you know, even putting old Champion, the oil company, you know, like with Brad Pitt's yeah. shirt back yep. into the four, you know, into pop culture again. You know, that's the thing. Like, I think that Quentin Tarantino does is it's not a shock because he's a pop culture fanatic, obviously. So it would be natural for him to create products in his films, like pseudo, you know, Fox mm-hmm. products, creating like Camel's a fixture in pop culture. So now that you have the Red Apple Worm is a fixture in Tarantino's universe of pop culture. You know what I mean? So he's creating his own. That he's a postmodern filmmaker, so he's naturally going to do that because his love of pop culture shines through in those products. They become popular pop culture in his universe. You know, that's why I think he does it. And I think that the character tie-ins really is for the audience.
Agreed. You know, for his fans. Go,
maybe we'll get a Vega Brothers movie. You know, maybe we'll get this. Maybe we'll have like both of them. So I think he does that for the enjoyment of the audience. And I think he does the placement products for the audience too, but more for himself. I think he gets a kick out of it. And, you know, and it becomes talk, like, you know, and you see it. You see it, and I think it's symbols for his films. Like, you see the billboards for Red Apple cigarettes. You see Butch go up to the bar and ask for, you know, Red Apple non-filter. And, the you know, she gives him the tin. And you see the logo, which is pop culture, the Red Apple logo. You know, so it's not surprising, and I think it's great that he does that. I enjoy that. And also, I think that it ties into, I think some of them tie into subliminal messages that Tarantino, like, for instance, Kill Bill series with the pussy wagon keychain. That's a feminist statement. You know, it's an ironic thing. It's irony because pussy's like kind of a frat boy term. Yeah. Like, you know, let's hit some pussy or let's get some. And she's a feminist, you know, a strong woman. So that the irony that
it's like taking that word and taking the power back, like taking the word bitch. Yep.
Yeah. So that's what I think he's secretly doing too for the audience. That you know, in like, you know, like Red Apple, apples are good for you, but they're cigarettes. You know what I mean? Apples are good for your eyes, you know, they're good for your blood and everything else, and it's fruit, and yet it's advertising, you know, canned cigarettes. You know what I mean?
However, it does have a worm coming out of it, letting you know that this apple is not good for you.
That,
which is kind of smart, you know what I mean? Yeah.
So I think it's not by he's thinking about this stuff and you know, and going in his head, and, you know, same thing with Kevin Smith. And I think kind of Spike Lee kind of does his time kind of thing too. Cause they're all kind of the similar renegade filmmakers, from the same cut from the same cloth, just different aspects. Like, you know, Smith is like, you know, dialogue, but it's for a college crowd. It's comedic, it's lighthearted. Tarantino is more, you know, on the pop culture, like that action thriller side, storytelling, character centeredness, and Spike is, you know, telling stories of New York. It's self-preservation almost too. It's like where you can say, you know, like you mentioned something and it's Tarantino, like, you know what I mean? It draws discussion. I think it's great.
I find it very enjoyable for us as fans too, because it is that nice little bingo card moment where you go, oh, I see that. And what I like about what he does with it is it's not thrown in your face a lot of times. Now, obviously, sometimes we will bring it up. Like, he orders a pack of Red Apples, and then when Tarantino does the voiceover and he's talking about what's happening after they poison the coffee, that Bob rolled himself a Roja Manzano, a Red Apple. Sometimes he puts it in your face, but other times it's very subtle. Like, even after we've seen the Jackrabbit Slims, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit, there's a commercial as Butch is making his way to his apartment about going to a local Jackrabbit Slims near you that you can hear in the window of the housing apartment as he's going through. So there's this little moment. It just ties you into this world. And I like the fact that a lot of times it's subtle. So if you see it, you see it. If you don't, you don't. But when you see it as a fan, you go, there it is.
Yeah. Moment. Like, okay. It's like, now it brings me to the point when you just said that, like in Reservoir Dogs, the Billy's Super Sounds of the
70s. Yeah.
You know, like, that's just, it's ingenious, you know? Yes. It's like, we all love those retro stations we've all heard. He created his own, and he's playing, like, Steeler's Wheel, which is such an obscure song. Yes. You know, it's
not anymore,
song.
It's not. Not anymore. But, you know,
right, not
it
anymore.
It was then, yeah.
But it was, you know, out of the dungeons, like, nobody, you know, and it's a fantastic song, but it's like, you know, Tarantino brought it out to the pop culture again. And who's, you know, it's great. Super Sounds of the 70s.
Just genius.
When you hear that, you think of Tarantino.
Agreed. I don't hear the song and not think of Tarantino or the movie. Whatever it may have been tied to before, it's gone. It is now.
You hear it on the radio and automatically Tarantino.
Automatically. I'm thinking, all right, I'm cutting the cops. I've got the shirt on as we're talking about. I'm cutting the cop's ear off. I got a dance. I got a razor out there. I don't think of it other than that.
And it's such a great song, too.
Yeah.
Long before there was an MCU, Quentin Tarantino was constructing his own cinematic universe. Tarantino has created several fictional brands that have appeared across his cinematic universes. The fast food chain Big Kahuna Burger is most prominently displayed in Pulp Fiction when Vincent and Jules interrupt Brett's breakfast. However, the chain is also referenced or visible in Reservoir Dogs, Death Proof, Four Rooms, From Dusk Till Dawn, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. A Big Kahuna bag even pops up in Robert Rodriguez's The Adventures of Sharkboy and Lava Girl, although we doubt that's part of any Tarantino universe. Rick Dalton stars in an ad for Red Apple Cigarettes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but that is far from the first time this fictional cigarette brand has surfaced in a Tarantino movie. It's also featured in Pulp Fiction, From Dusk Till Dawn, Four Rooms, Kill Bill, and The Hateful Eight. Another notable brand created by Tarantino is G.O. Juice, which can be seen in both Death Proof and Kill Bill. And let's be honest, there isn't a Tarantino fan alive who hasn't wanted to bite into a tasty Big Kahuna burger and wash it down with G.O. Juice.
Hit the spot.
Red Apple Cigarettes first appeared in Reservoir Dogs in 1992, when a pack briefly sits on a table. Since then, the product's prominence grew over time as the distinctively yellow and red cigarette packs have popped up in the background of multiple Tarantino films across the decades. It was not until 1994's Pulp Fiction that a Red Apple was smoked on screen by Mia Wallace. The brand continued on through the Kill Bill films, Death Proof, and all the way up to 2019's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, beyond Tarantino's films, Red Apple Cigarettes have become a cult pop culture reference. The fictional brand has been featured in other movies and TV shows for fun nods to Tarantino fans. Red Apple even appeared in some 90s convenience stores as a prop, tying it to the Pulp Fiction hype. While not crucial to any plot, Red Apple Cigarettes are a fun, reoccurring fictional product that symbolize the consistent, nostalgic universe Tarantino has constructed through his interconnected films across time periods. The cigarettes are a subtle way he links the aesthetics and details of his stylized cinematic worlds for audiences to discover. They have been featured in Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Four Rooms, From Dusk Till Dawn, Kill Bill, Death Proof, Inglourious Basterds, The Hateful Eight, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and even in Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion.
Really?
Yes. He used to date Mira Sorvino. So that was her movie. Pops in. They're actually smoking one. Actually, I'm sorry. They're not smoking one. There's actually a billboard or a sign in one of the scenes, just like in Kill Bill. So, Mr. Damiano, when did you first recognize the Red Apple brand that you are so proudly wearing a sweatshirt of? And what is your personal favorite fake product from his large yet small to some universe?
Well, I saw the Red Apple in Reservoir Dogs when on the tape, the night the table stand, Tim Roth has all the stuff. That's when I saw it. And, you know, it's a vibrant pack.
Yes.
Great design logo. And then, you know, I saw it in Pulp Fiction and throughout all of his films. It's one of my favorites, but I like the bad motherfucker wallet. That's just funny to me.
Yeah.
It's a line of wallet, you know, bad motherfucker. Jules, mm-hmm. when he says, like, I'm a bad motherfucker, you know, like the wallet, yeah. like...
Because when he says, which one's yours? The one that says bad motherfucker on it. And at the time, you're kind of like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, all right. And then when he pulls it out, it is like a little, it's like a funny gag.
And they sell those too.
I have one. I'm not going to lie to you. I own one. Yes.
You have them? I just thought that was funny. Like, you know, it's so Jules. But I think the pussy wagon keychain is hilarious. Mm-hmm. A lot of them I like, but I just think that wallet is hilarious.
A lot of the stuff comes from this film. Like, we get introductions of it in Reservoir Dogs, but kind of the plot is more important in Reservoir Dogs. And then it's almost like they're hinted at. And then Pulp Fiction, he felt, you know what, I'm going to go for broke and I'm going to start to really break these out and, you know, kind of have people say, oh, okay, right. I know what that is, you know, because I remember seeing it, but it's not until they order it and then you see it like in Pulp Fiction, and you start going, oh, okay, this is important. Then you go back and rewatch Reservoir Dogs, you go, oh, there it is. Again, no one really knew Reservoir Dogs that there was going to be fake products. Like when you saw Red Apple, you thought that's a regular cigarette brand. Like you weren't thinking some guy decided to create his own brand.
Maybe some cigarette brand in Australia or something or England, you know. Like,
yeah. Here. Or like one you get off the reservations. Those of people who are not American. A lot of people will go get cheap cigarettes on our Native American reservations here in America because there's not the tobacco tax.
But let me ask you this. Where do you think you came up with that? That's what I like. Like Red Apple in the logo.
That's a great fucking question. Something I should have looked up, but I did not. I did not think about where he came up with that. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm not sure either. I would like to know. That would be interesting to know.
I feel like I dropped the ball on this when I look it up for this one, you know?
No, I mean, you know, hey, you know, just would be interesting. Maybe it was just something that popped up in his head or something.
It has to be something that came from something he saw, you know, probably from a show or something he remembered, like maybe even, this is going to sound weird for younger, but you used to be able to go down with just a letter and buy your grandmother or grandparents cigarettes at the convenience store. Things were different back when we were growing up.
Hi, this is Rick Dalton, better known as Bounty Hunter Jake Cahill, speaking on behalf of Red Apple Cigarettes. Now, I smoke Red Apples, been smoking them for years, but since the Red Apple Tobacco Company's been around since 1862, you'll see Jake Cahill smoke Red Apple too. Now, back in Jake's day, Red Apple came in a pouch and he had to roll his own. But today, Red Apple comes factory rolled for the best drag with the best tobacco flavor with less burn on your throat than any other non-filter cigarette. Well, that's the way a cigarette should taste. Better drag, more flavor, less throat burn. That's the Red Apple way. So look for this life-size standee of me, Jake Cahill, wherever fine Red Apple tobacco products are sold. Take a bite and feel all right. Take a bite of a Red Apple. Tell him Jake sent you.
And cut.
All right, this cigarette tastes like fucking shit. And by the way, who chose this photo, all right? I have a double chin, all right? Nobody notices that crap.
Now, another one of his big, no pun intended, but one of his big influences or big products is Big Kahuna Burger. Now, Big Kahuna Burger made its first official on-screen appearance in 1994 in Pulp Fiction, when Jules asked Brad where he got his burger from. However, its existence was alluded to in 1992's Reservoir Dogs, when Mr. Blonde is holding one of its cups minus a logo. Obviously, when we get to Pulp Fiction, the logo has been added, and now we know that those two are tied together. Since its debut, however, Big Kahuna Burger has gone on to make appearances in several other Tarantino films. It shows up once again in From Dusk Till Dawn, when Seth Gecko returns to the motel after scouting out the Mexican border. It also gets referenced in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and in Death Proof. Beyond Tarantino's own films, Big Kahuna Burger has become a recurring pop culture gag and reference to Tarantino's signature style. Fans have even created real-life Big Kahuna Burger recipes and 3D-printed memorabilia of the mascot and cups. While not pivotal, again, to any plot points, Big Kahuna Burger is a fun, recurring fictional fast food chain that exemplifies how Tarantino has built a consistent universe of references and brands that tie stylized films together. It acts as an inside joke for Tarantino fans to spot, while helping to create the quirky atmosphere of his movie universe. The films this faux burger chain has popped up in are Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Four Rooms, From Dusk Till Dawn, Death Proof, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and, once again, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, along with The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl. Now, Mr. Damiano, with the popularity of these fake products and companies, why do you think we haven't seen some of them become a reality? And in your opinion, does his inclusion of fake brands add an air of realism to the world his films exist in?
I don't think he wants them to come to become real products, in my opinion, personally. My opinion, I don't think he does. Just know, I think he wants to keep them in his universe.
You might be right. However, back in the time, it was owned by Miramax. And in the next section we talk about, we might talk about something that almost did come to reality.
Could be something legal, it could be like...
Yeah, probably a legal thing.
But I think in his mind, I don't know. I never met the... You know, but I'm just saying, like... If my opinion, I don't think he wants them to become real products.
Well, the funny thing is in the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when we have our little kind of end scene where Rick is doing his commercial for Red Apple, and he says, guys, like, these taste like shit, and punches his his stand. He clearly is making a statement about, you know, look, I know that we're smoking this, but they're really not good for you. So the other question was, does the inclusion of these fake brands add an air of realism to the world of his films?
Add a realism? No, I don't think they're intended to, you know, I think they're fun, playful things that just Quentin Tarantino likes to do. Yeah, people smoke, people eat, people, you know, have waffles, they have keychains. So there is a certain realism to them. But I think he just likes logos and in things that become popular and like, you know, like I think he wants to create, like, I've had this discussion before, too, with other people about Tarantino, is I think Quentin Tarantino likes to, he gets a kick out of, like, I'll give examples. Instead of saying copying machine, we say Xerox.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think he's into that.
Instead of tissue, like, we say Kleenex.
Right, right. Is strong, prominent things that become a part of pop culture, and you mm-hmm. know you're talking about tissues when you say Kleenex,
mm-hmm.
because it's a top brand. That's what I think Tarantino has done with his universe. You don't say cigarette, red apple. Butch says, I have a red apple, pack of red apples. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. that's Tarantino doing that. Xerox machine. It's not. Xerox is the company. It's a copying machine. You know what I mean? Like, that is what he's doing, basically. You know, product placement.
Even with Big Kahuna Burger, too, yeah.
Yeah. You don't say burger, you say Whopper. You go to Burger yeah. King, it's known as a Whopper, or McDonald's, it's known as a Big Mac.
Do you think that McDonald's missed out on turning the Quarter Pounder with cheese into the Royale with cheese in America? Do you think that's something they should have jumped on? Yeah. You know, I mean, because it's what it's called, obviously, overseas. Now, they could have.
When the movie came out, they should have jumped on it if it was okay with Quentin Tarantino to do that.
Well, you know, actually, they don't have to ask him, because I do have some friends overseas. It's because they don't have the metric system, just like he says in the film. So they actually do call it a Royale with cheese over there. So I'm just wondering why they just didn't say, you know what, fuck the Quarter Pounder.
Let's do it.
Yeah, just do the, because the Whopper doesn't tell you how much meat's there. You know what I mean? The Whopper just said, we're a Whopper.
Right.
I'm surprised. Like you said, it's one of the more quotable moments, the Royale with cheese. And I'm surprised McDonald's missed out on a valid opportunity to just, I mean, just even to cash in on, not even to have to tie in, because they already own the rights to that name anyways, because it's being used in their European marketing. So just use it here. I'm surprised they still haven't, but I'm not in charge of McDonald's and they're doing just fine. So they don't need my fucking help.
No, that would be fun. That'd be a pretty cool idea, man. You know, they just, maybe nobody thought of it, you know, missed opportunity. Yeah.
Someone missed out.
Yeah. Royal with cheese. Yeah.
Royal with cheese.
Popular dialogues, for sure.
And you know, other companies have done that now. And they've, you know, they have the Royale with cheese burger because, like I said, McDonald's didn't jump on it to trademark it or anything like that. So you missed out, Double Arches. You missed out.
Sure. Not that they need the money, but.
No, they're doing fine. Yeah. At this point, don't even need to keep the sign of how many people they've served at this point. We get it. It's a lot to stop.
Bad food for you. But,
oh, it is. Yes.
Looks like me and Vincent caught you boys at breakfast. Sorry about that. What you having?
Hamburgers.
The cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
What kind of hamburgers? Cheeseburgers.
No. Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, where?
Big Kahuna Burger.
That's that Hawaiian burger joint. I hear they got some tasty burgers. I ain't never had one myself. How are they?
They're good.
You mind if I try one of yours? This is yours here, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is a tasty burger. Vincent, you ever had a Big Kahuna Burger? Want a bite? They're real tasty.
Ain't hungry.
Well, if you like burgers, give them a try sometime. Me? I can't usually get them because my girlfriend's a vegetarian, which pretty much makes me a vegetarian. But I do love the taste of a good burger. Mm.
Now, the one place that has been as sought after as any in the Tarantino universe is Jackrabbit Slim's. Now, we were introduced to this now iconic 1950s themed restaurant where Mia and Vincent go on their not a date, but a date that culminates in the even more iconic twist contest. With its colorful neon decor, servers dressed as Marilyn Monroe and Buddy Holly, and an Ed Sullivan lookalike host, it encapsulates Tarantino's vintage aesthetic. Pulp Fiction is Jackrabbit Slim's only on-screen appearance in the Tarantinoverse. However, it is mentioned in a commercial on the radio in Reservoir Dogs right after Mr. Orange shoots Mr. Blonde. Beyond Tarantino's films, Jackrabbit Slim's has become a quintessential pop culture symbol of his retro-inspired style. Fans have created real-life versions of the diner's novelty milkshake and menu. The real-life building used as the exterior for the restaurant was a recently closed bowling alley named Grand Central Bowl, located at 1435 Flower Street, which was adjacent to Walt Disney Imagineering. In 1997, Disney purchased the 125-acre site and incorporated it into their Grand Central Creative Campus. Now, the exterior remains the same. However, it's been updated but doesn't have the bowling or even the Jackrabbit Slim's on it, but that W-like roof is still prominent to the building. Now, the set built for the interior of the restaurant was inspired by the 1968 Elvis Presley film Speedway and the 1965 film Redline 7000. The impact of this nostalgia-filled restaurant was palpable with audience for over a decade after the film's release, so much so that fans visiting L.A. would seek out the location of it only to discover that it didn't actually exist. There was so much interest in the pop culture diner that Disney, who owned Miramax at the time, wanted to recreate Jackrabbit Slim's as an actual restaurant at their Disney World Resort in Orlando, Florida. Production designers David Wasko and set director Sandy Reynolds Wasko were approached to work on the project, but they walked away from it as they felt it would never live up to what had been captured in the film. Now, Mr. Damiano, how badly do you wish Jackrabbit Slim's had become a reality? And is there a more iconic location in any other Tarantino film?
Well, the first question, I think that would be just a really fucking fun place to go. I probably would be in there every weekend, you know, to have a guy like, you know, coming up, you know, the iconic movie stars of the 50s would be super fun, man. And then I would even dance, and I don't dance. I would even get up and just reach out and, you know, do all that kind of fun, shaking my ass type shit. And that's not me. And I can imagine the food's probably really fun and themed. Yeah. And, you know, see a woman dressed as Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield and stuff like that. And it would just be fun. It'd just be a fun place to go to, man, you know, with a bunch of people and just grab it. And, you know, how many people are wondering what a $5 milkshake tastes like?
Well, nowadays, that's a bargain.
That's a bargain.
In 2024, right? 30 years later, $5 milkshake, that's a fucking bargain.
Exactly. But back in, 94, it was kind of steep. So, you know, that line is so iconic. But, you know, they probably be pretty darn good milkshakes. But, you know, they probably, like, it's themed burgers, themed food, great music. It would just be a hoot to go to, man. It'd be pretty, you know, fun place.
Do you think that, let's say it got built. Do you think, because obviously as we move through time, we're 30 years past the 90s, right? So do you think the aesthetics would have to kind of change as well? Because after a while, 1950s style is no longer in style, just like 1920s style is no longer in style. Do you think, like, by now we're into the 80s style, and then like a decade later, you know, you kind of keep three decades behind, yeah, but you have to kind of move it?
It would probably be like a new wave 80s
theme right now.
Theme with like a dude coming up to you with a flock of seagulls.
Yeah, and there'd be like, and instead of the go-karts, there'd be like, you have like a video games, like the old consoles and stuff.
There'd be people dressed like New Romantic, Duran Duran.
Someone would be wearing a Michael Jackson, one of his many coats.
Right. You know, some lady looking like Cyndi Lauper and stuff. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, to bring it up to the times, decade-wise. Yeah, I think that would be even more, that would be awesome. That's a place I would go to. Sure. Yeah, I mean, and is there a more iconic place? Well, that warehouse was pretty badass.
Yep.
You know, it was an old, dingy warehouse, but the aesthetics, just, it worked.
Yeah.
You know, because it's essentially the whole second and third act is in that warehouse.
Yeah.
Where it's taking place. You know what I mean? Like, so I think that, you know, it fits great. It's not as flashy, obviously, as Jack Slim's on, but no, I mean, it's probably the most known place in Tarantino films or mentioned. Mm-hmm. Everybody mentions that scene and knows that scene, you know, because they dance and they get up and they dance and stuff, and Travolta takes his shoes off, and Uma Thurman's great in that scene. And yeah, I mean, probably is the most.
The only one I could think of that's, you know, not really the most known, but would have a similar aesthetic is obviously the written but not directed and starring Mr. Tarantino, being From Dusk Till Dawn, being the titty twister.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just because of the name and the outside. But
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's almost like the dark version of Jackrabbit Slim's. It's the titty twister, you know?
I forgot about that.
But the outside's cool, but the inside, not so much. It's, you know, it's a dingy bar. But again, another kind of similar. Yeah. We got that sexy dance. So those two, but always Jackrabbit Slim's always comes to mind to me. It always is that one moment, that one place. Because like you said, there's so much iconic stuff happening in that moment. You're kind of sucked in. Like, you realize this is like his introduction. He's introducing us fully to his love of pop culture in that moment when, you know, even when she says, this is an Elvis, man, which should love this place kind of thing. You know, right away that, you know, we're not playing in his world.
Yeah, I think what he did was, you know, he's a child of, which is relatable. Probably me and you are the same way. I know I am. He's a product of things growing up that he remembers. years. Like, you know, me and, you know, we're around the same, you know who Mikey is and you know he likes it.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Like, you know, so you get where I'm going with.
We're products of the boomer parents. He's early. He's an early Gen X. We're the end of the, we're the tail end of Gen X. So his references are a little early. Like little for him, he knows a little early 60s, but he's more of a 70s guy. We're like early, late 70s, but 80s. We're more like 80s kids, you know? So we had, we're growing up a decade apart, but we're still in that Gen X mentality. We're latchkey kids. You know what I mean? Our parents let, you know, good or bad. We watch a lot of movies that we shouldn't know.
Of great shows.
Yes. Yes.
Thinking they're a regular, like Three's Company. Yes. You know, you thought it was a regular, but it's a rerun.
Yes, I know.
You know what I mean?
I watched Good Times with my brother. We thought it was
I can't tell you how many times I referenced Jack Tripper or, you know, the Regal Beagle. You know, I just grew up watching that show. But I mean, that's what Tarantino is, a product of a television baby, a movie goer at a young age, and those things have resonated in his self-conscious. It comes out in his creativity, it comes out in his films, because it's so saturated in there. Mm-hmm. You know, like even like, you know, the Cool and the Gang. I use that reference all the time. Like, how's everything cool in the gang?
Yeah.
You know,
like,
that's Tarantino listening to Cool and the Gang. Kid, you know, pre-teen. Listening to, like, you know,
clearly Jungle Boogie.
I love Kool and the Gang. They get some great songs, but that's, you know, nobody else would do that. You know what I mean? But, you know, he uses all the stuff that he loved and remembers as a kid.
The fuck is this place?
This is Jack Rabbit Slim's. An Elvis man should love it.
Come on, man, let's go get a steak.
You can get a steak here, Daddy-O. Don't be a...
Oh, after you, kitty cat.
What do you think?
I think it's like a wax museum with a pulse.
Hi, I'm Buddy. Can I get you?
Let's see. Steak. Oh, yeah. Oh, the Douglas Sirk steak. Have that.
How do you want that cooked? Burnt to a crisp or bloody as hell?
Bloody as hell and, oh, yeah, look at this. Vanilla Coke.
What about you, Peggy Sue?
I'll have the Durward Kirby burger, bloody, and a $5 shake.
How do you want that shake? Martin and Lewis or Amos and Andy?
Martin and Lewis.
Now, while his movies are not directly sequels or even tell an overarching narrative, Tarantino hints that characters are related across films through the surnames to imply his movies share a universe. For example, it is hinted that Vic Vega, a.k.a. Mr. Blonde, from Reservoir Dogs, and Vincent Vega from Pulp Fiction are brothers, obviously through their same last name. This use of suggestive family ties rewards fans for picking up on the references. It adds depth to the interconnected universe and allows Tarantino to reuse character names in creative ways. The subtle connections encourage fans to theorize how the films fit together in Tarantino's world through these crossover details. Another example of this is with the Dimmick family. Now, Jimmy Dimmick, your favorite character in this world, the N-word saying gourmet coffee loving suburban homeowner who allows Jules and Vincent to use his garage while they sort out their Marvin situation, appears in Pulp Fiction, while his surname is referenced in a line of dialogue in Reservoir Dogs, that being Larry Dimmick, aka Mr. White. Now, their immediate family connection is unknown. However, it does provide another direct link between the two films. The vague connections between the Dimmicks and the Vegas exemplify how Tarantino peppers in hints of a shared history and a congruent theme between his movies' narratives. This adds to the fun of piecing together the mysteries and intricacies of his stylized cinematic universe. Mr. Damiano, what was your first reaction to learning that Vincent Vega from Pulp Fiction was somehow related to Vic Vega, Mr. Blonde, from Reservoir Dogs? And of all the names that have kind of filtered through in the last 9 films, who is your favorite family connection in the Tarantino verse?
Probably the Vega brothers, to be honest with you.
Because I think they're like the two main characters we know.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy was funny, but you just think of Jimmy. You don't really think of Mr. White.
Yeah.
I mean, Harvey Keitel was badass, but you think of him as Mr. White. You know what I mean? Like, I even forgot, to be honest with you, his last name was the same as Jim. You know what I mean? But the Vegas, you really get that connect. You're like, okay, Michael Madsen, Mr. Blonde, mm-hmm. is he being related to, they're similar guys, the same business pretty much.
Yeah.
And I could really see a Vega Brothers film. I thought that would be awesome if you know, of course, Vince Vega didn't die. You know what I mean? And I can't remember. Did Mr. Blonde?
They're both dead.
Yeah, they both died. So that would have been cool though. But you always see the mock memes and the mock that people do, like the Vega brothers.
It was the first thing he announced. Yeah, well, so they were going to do a sequel, a prequel. It was supposed to be the time that it's probably happened around the first couple of months that Vincent is in Amsterdam. Vic is supposed to go over there and visit. And then some stuff is supposed to happen. And that was one of the films that was supposed to possibly be next after Pulp Fiction instead of Jackie Brown. Obviously, it never came to fruition. Tarantino still has kept it alive as a possibility in a book, which would then lead to a possibility of maybe someone adapting it and doing it. But again, I think fans would want it as a book, because I don't know that we want someone to recast it, because as a fan of From Dusk Till Dawn, I can appreciate that Robert Rodriguez went ahead and created From Dusk Till Dawn series. And while enjoyable, it is hard to see the new Gecko brothers not be Quentin and not be George. Yeah. You know, so it's like, do I want to see anybody else play Mr. Blonde and Vincent? No, I really don't. So I'd love to get a book. I'd love to be able to read a novel.
I'm such a fan of Michael Madsen, too.
I love him. Yeah. Like, you can't, it's not them. At this point, we don't need it.
I just bought a movie that was under the radar called Vice with Daryl Hannah. And I'm looking to see that. It's a cop, kind of a cop thriller. But yeah, Madsen's great. What a badass. He's just a genuine article, man. He's just such an engaging actor. You know, I always liked Michael Madsen. Every movie he's in. He does those movies. They're Tarantino-esque, like Hell Ride. That's such a Tarantino film. You know, anything Michael Madsen really does, I have that on DVD. It's a great film, Hell Ride. Very fun film. But I would like, that would be great to see like a pre-Pulp Fiction.
It would have been fun.
Pre-Reservoir Dogs, Vega type of story of how they became criminals. You know what I mean? Like in that world. I'm surprised I could see them doing something like that.
It would have been fun. It would have been fun. I know it was one of the original things that people in the Tarantino fandom really got jacked about. We got really juiced about it, you know, but just never came to light. And unfortunately, at this point, it's not going to come to light unless he does eventually, when he's done with his directing career, finish and write a novel of it. And I would love to. I would love for that to happen.
Yeah, that would be a cool book. Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I was thinking we forgot one thing in the Tarantino universe. Fox Force 5.
Without that, we would not have Kill Bill. I mean, we really wouldn't. That would be a fun little thing to see. I mean, obviously, what Kill Bill is and what Fox Force 5 is are two different things. Like, he kept some of the aesthetics out, but obviously what Mia's show that she was going to be on and what the movie we ended up getting, there are similarities, clearly. There's women and they're killers. Or actually, in Kill Bill, the divas are killers, but in Fox Force, they're more Charlie's Angel type. They're more, they're on the side of good. They're more crime fighting.
Take on Charlie's
exactly.
Angels,
it was. Yes. It was almost like he was kind of hoping that what Charlie's Angels was in his world, a little more violence, that they do a little bit more than just look good and do a couple karate kicks and solve the case every time.
What a great scene that was, though, when she's explaining it to him.
Yes. Great. Spectacular. You know. And it's one of those great moments that we.
Yeah. And it's a totally made up show in
totally,
his universe.
Completely made up. And it's funny that line of dialogue and them working together would lead to Kill Bill. Like, I've always said, if you're a Gen Xer, your entry point probably to Tarantino is this film, Pulp Fiction. However, if you're a millennial, you would have been a very young child when Pulp Fiction came out, so it wouldn't have been your entry point. Kill Bill, for me, but for a lot of my millennial friends who have been on the podcast, Kill Bill's usually their entry point, and then they go backwards and they see the other stuff, because Kill Bill came out in 2003 and then 2004, so we're talking 9-10 years after Pulp Fiction, so it makes sense. But those two movies are like those two touch points, and that would be my two favorite movies in Tarantino world, but those two touch points were like, you get in, you know, you get in where you fit in, you know what I mean? Like, we got to experience the change in cinema with Pulp Fiction, but they got to experience the beginning of what I call Tarantino just basically going, oh, I like this genre of film. Watch how good I can make this be.
Well, that's the thing. If you like these young people will go back and see is in his filmography is basically what Quentin Tarantino has done is he's made his own films in all the styles he liked. He made his criminal heist film, Reservoir Dogs. He made his homage to criminal heist films with Reservoir Dogs. He made his anthology in a film based off of old comic type of crime stuff of Pulp Fiction, right? He made his homage to Kung Fu flicks, the old Kung Fu flicks, like The Drunken Master and all those kind of things with Kill Bill, but with a feminine with a female protagonist. He made his homage to spaghetti westerns twice with like Hateful Eight and Django Unchained.
And he kind of does a bit of blaxploitation with the Django Unchained and even Jackie Brown.
Jackie Brown, yeah. Right. He's blaxploitation with, the dual. I think, correct me, but Jackie Brown is kind of his homage to Alfred Hitchcock, if you think about it a little bit. It's very Hitchcock with the bag.
He also is paying his love to doing it Elmore Leonard as well. And he's right. Paying that homage to how right. much Elmore Leonard really, influenced morality, his writing. Yeah.
Morality mm-hmm. play. Morality plays films. His war homage in Glorious Bastards. This
slasher
is what
films in Death Proof. His own version right. of a slasher film that's the car right. is the weapon and not an actual film. Knife. Yeah. Yep.
Which I love Death Proof too. It gets a lot of hate.
I love it why. As well. Mm-hmm.
And his homage to timepieces with Once Upon a Time mm-hmm. in Hollywood, set in the 60s, kind of retro timepiece film. Mm-hmm. So that's what he did as well. So he made his own style or versions of what he loved in each film.
And I think that's what all great directors do. I think that's what all great directors do. Right. They find something they love and they make their version of it.
And, he is, like I said, he's a rare genre. I don't know if I'd say genre, but he's a weird offset style of filmmaking.
He's a maverick.
There's not a lot of postmodern filmmakers. He's, mm-hmm. he's up there with that. So there's really nothing to really compare. I can't even really think of really anybody mm-mm. that's doing it like he does. You know what I mean?
He's a one of a kind.
Yeah. But essentially it's postmodernism. And that's not an often mentioned film movement. It's kind of a niche thing. I guess Scorsese's kind of too, but not to the extent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because with his use of music and street style, Scorsese and, Tarantino got a lot of that from mm-hmm. him. You know what I mean? But in the dialogue and stuff, they mention a lot of hip stuff in Scorsese films too. And I think that QT picked up on a lot of that. Yeah, though only those two really, so it's kind of his own niche, it's like Tarantino-esque, yeah. Now these films are taken up on that. Like I said, your viewers, I hope they go back and check out 68 Kill. It's on one of the streaming services. I don't know which one, but I wrote a review for it on Letterboxd. It's a really great film. I highly recommend it. It's very, very Tarantino-esque.
68 Kill is currently for free here in America on Tubi. Can also get it free on Plex, and you can also watch it with an AMC Plus subscription if you don't want to watch it for free, or rent it on Apple for $3.99, depending what you know. Hey, look, depending on what you got, and depending on where you are as well. I don't know if Tubi and Plex are overseas. If so, then you can see it for free on there, and it's going to be one of the movies that I'm now going to check out as well.
It's an awesome movie. I really enjoyed it. They did it very well, because some of them don't. Some of them try too hard.
Vic Vega's outside.
Hold on.
Oh, Vic Vega.
Oh, tell him to come in. I got to go.
Come on in.
Friend of mine's outside. Keep your chin up. I'll be talking to you. Don't worry. Hey, welcome home, Vic. How does freedom feel, huh?
It's a change.
Ain't that the sad truth? Sit down, take your coat off, make yourself at home. A little drink?
Yeah.
How about a little Remy Martin?
Sure.
Who's your parole officer?
Seymour Scagnetti.
How is he?
He's a fucking asshole. Won't even let me leave the halfway house.
It never ceases to amaze me. Fucking jungle bunny goes out there, slits some old woman's throat for 25 cents. He gets Doris Day for a parole officer. Good fella like you winds up with a ball-busting prick.
I want you to know I appreciate all the packages you sent me on the inside.
Hey, what the hell was I supposed to do? Forget about you?
I just want you to know that it meant a lot to me.
Hey, it was the least I could do. I wish the hell I could have done a lot more.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
All right, let me just say this out loud, because I want to get this straight in my head. You're saying that Mr. Blonde was going to kill you, and then when we got back, he was going to kill us, take the satchel of diamonds, and scram. I'm right about that, right? That's correct. That's your story?
I swear on my mother's eternal soul, this is what happened.
The man you just killed just got released from prison. He got caught at a company warehouse full of hot items. He could have fucking walked. All he had to do was say my dad's name, but he didn't. He kept his fucking mouth shut. And he did his fucking time, and he did it like a man. He did 4 years for us. So, Mr. Orange, you're telling me that this very good friend of mine, who did 4 years for my father, who in 4 years never made a deal no matter what they dangled in front of him, you're telling me that now that this man is free and we're making good on our commitment to him, he's just gonna decide out of the fucking blue to rip us off?
Oh, Vincent Vega, our man in Amsterdam. Jules Winfield, our man in Inglewood. Get your asses out in here.
Okay, so tell me again about the hash bar.
Okay, what you want to know?
Hash is legal, man, right?
Now, it's legal, but it ain't 100% legal. I mean, you just can't walk into a restaurant, roll the joint, and start puffing away. I mean, they want you to smoke in your home or certain designated places.
And those are hash bars.
Yeah, it breaks down like this, okay. It's legal to buy it. It's legal to own it. And if you're the proprietor of a hash bar, it's legal to sell it. It's legal to carry it, but that doesn't matter, because get a load of this, all right? If you get stopped by a cop in Amsterdam, it's illegal for them to search you. I mean, that's the right that cops in Amsterdam don't have.
Oh, man, I'm going. That's all it is to it. I'm fucking going.
No, baby, you dig it the most. But you know what the funniest thing about Europe is?
What?
It's a little differences. I mean, they got the same shit over there that they got here, but it's just there, it's a little different.
Example.
All right, well, you can walk into a movie theater in Amsterdam and buy a beer. And I don't mean just like a little paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer. And in Paris, you can buy a beer in McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
Oh, man, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what the fuck a quarter pounder is.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a
Whopper? I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
Before you got here, Mr. Orange was asking me to take him to a doctor or a hospital. Now, I don't like the idea of turning him over to the cops. But if we don't, he's going to die. He begged me to do it.
Well, all right, then I guess we take him to a hospital. I mean, if that's what he said, let's do it. Since he don't know nothing about us, I say it's his decision.
Well, he knows a little about me.
Why? Wait, you didn't tell him your name, did you?
I told him my first name and where I was from.
Why?
I told him where I was from a few days ago. It was just a natural conversation.
What was telling him your name when you weren't supposed to?
He asked. We had just gotten away from the cops. He just got shot. It was my fault he got shot. He's a fucking bloody mess. He's screaming. I swear to God, I thought he was gonna die right then and there. I'm trying to comfort him. Telling him not to worry, everything's gonna be okay, I'm gonna take care of him. And he asked me what my name was. I mean, the man was dying in my arms. What the fuck was I supposed to do? Tell him I'm sorry? I can't give out that fucking information. It's against the rules. I don't trust you enough. Or maybe I should have, but I couldn't. Fuck you and fuck Joe.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a very beautiful scene between you.
Don't fucking patronize me.
I have a question for you. Do they have a sheet on you where you're from?
Yeah.
Well, that's that then, man. But I mean, Jesus Christ, I was worried about mugshot possibilities as it was. Now he knows A, your name, B, what you look like, C, where you're from, and D, what your specialty is. They're not gonna have to show him a hell of a lot of pictures for him to pick you out.
All right, Lawrence Larry Dimmock, also known as Lawrence Jacobs and Alvin Al Jacobs. This guy is Mr. Joe Armed Robbery. He's a pro, and he makes it a habit not to get caught. He's only been convicted twice, which is pretty good for a guy living a life of crime. Once for armed robbery when he was 21. In Milwaukee.
What was it?
It was a payroll office at a lumberyard. First offense, he got 18 months. He didn't get busted again until he was 32. It was a routine vice squad roust. You know, they roust this bar, Buddy Lawrence is in there knocking down a few. He gets picked up. They give him 2 years for that.
Ah, damn, it's a hard time.
So far, it's the only time he's ever done.
So this Vice Squad bullshit go down in Milwaukee?
No. No. Vice Squad Rouse was in L.A. He's lived in Los Angeles since 77.
God damn, Jimmy. This is some serious gourmet shit. Me and Vincent would have been satisfied with some freeze-dried Taster's Choice, right? And he springs this serious gourmet shit on us. What flavor is this?
Knock it off, Julie.
What?
I don't need you to tell me how fucking good my coffee is, okay? I'm the one who buys it. I know how good it is. When Bonnie goes shopping, she buys shit. I buy the gourmet expensive stuff because when I drink it, I want to taste it. But you know what's on my mind right now? It ain't the coffee in my kitchen.
Well, Jimmy, we're not going to store it.
Don't you fucking realize, man, that if Bonnie comes home and finds a dead body in her house, I'm going to get divorced. All right, no marriage counseling, no trial separation. I'm going to get fucking divorced, okay? And I don't want to get fucking divorced. I mean, you know, fuck. I mean, I want to help you, but I don't want to lose my wife doing it, all right?
Jimmy, she ain't going to leave.
Don't fucking Jimmy me, Jules, okay? Don't fucking Jimmy me. There's nothing that you're going to say that's going to make me forget that I love my wife, is there? Now, look, you know, she comes home from work in about an hour and a half. It's a graveyard shift at the hospital. You got to make some phone calls. You got to call some people. Well, then do it. And then get the fuck out of my house before she gets here.
Hey, that's cool in the gang. You know, we don't want to fuck your shit up. All I want to do is call my people, get them, bring us in. That's all.
You don't fuck my shit up. You're fucking my shit up right now. You're going to fuck my shit up big time if Bonnie comes home.
All right, we will wrap up this episode with your three for the road questions.
And now, here's three for the road.
What kind of impact do you feel this film has had on the movie industry since its release 30 years ago?
I think, again, it changed the face of cinema. It really, in 1994, there was nothing in the theaters like that out, nothing even similar. It brought postmodern filmmaking into the public eye, into the forefront, and Tarantino has created a style of cinema referred to the cinema of cool by using excessive relatable dialogue with obscure pop cultural references, and it became Tarantino-esque because nobody was using these kind of references. And there were references that he was just fans of as a kid, which I think is ingenious. So I think that, you know, he just made hip, you know, hip cinema. Catchy phrases around every corner, quirky characters that you remember, drawn dialogue that's engaging, quick edits, not real long shots, the antithesis of Kubrick, basically fast and, you know what I mean? Like flashy and that just, it became a style and it's in most of his films.
Now, in your opinion, what has Pulp Fiction's most enduring impact on pop culture been?
You know, it literally created a style of cinema. Basically, that's the impact. Other films reference it upon reference. They reference their films as Tarantino-esque. He created a violent, relatable dialogue, again, with several pop culture references, using character actors from the past that basically went into obscurity, brought them back into the limelight, used them well, and his scores, too. He scores all his own films and picks really, you know, from the vault songs that, again, fell into obscurity and nobody remembers, but loved when they were out, and puts them into his films and staple songs. Who uses like a Dusty Springfield song? I mean, nothing against Dusty Springfield. She was great. But you know what I mean? Like in The Son of a Preacher Man or an independent alternative band from the night that comes out with Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
That's their only real hit. Yeah.
You know, they're only a one hit wonder and just everybody knows that song. Yep. Now it thinks of that scene, thinks of Pulp Fiction when they hear that song. It definitely impactful. People talk about it, Pulp Fiction, till this day. And it's over 30 year old film. So it changed the way cinema was presented. It went from the tail end of the 80s, like the family-oriented 80s or, you know, or the action thighs, you know, outrageous scripts, over the top action type style of the late 80s and early 90s. And then when the early 90 independent boom came, that's when Tarantino really started to rise and became, you know, Tarantino. But, you know, there was no films like that out then. The cinema was dying. Like, you know, there was a time like where it was just a lot of shit. Like, besides, like, you know, I think the tip, like, you know, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Soderbergh's brilliant, 89. But then there was that lapse of 90, 91. And then, you know, I would say, I know we're talking about Pulp Fiction, but like Reservoir Dogs, yep, really, like, people were like, what the fuck? You know, like, wow, this is like, you know, start looking at cinema differently. And then like Pulp Fiction just brought it way over the edge. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this is stuff that I talk with my friends about. These are references I use with my friends. You know what I mean? In movies. So nobody was doing that. So 100% impactful.
And lastly, where does this film rank in your Tarantino filmography?
Well, I floated over with this. I'd have to, probably my overall favorite Tarantino film is probably Reservoir Dogs, to be honest with you, because that was my introduction into him as far as directing. But my favorite script by him is True Romance, without a doubt. But I also, like, my second, it teeters, I loved Hateful Eight. Mm-hmm. Just something about that movie. I loved the who is it, the thing influence aspect. You got to have all these people in a room, and one of them is the, you know, the mole, and you have to, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I also loved Jackie Brown. I thought it was a great story. But, you know, Pulp Fiction's definitely in my top three. It'd have to be probably Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Hateful Eight. Probably overall,
Hateful Eight's my number three as well. I absolutely love that movie.
You know, overall, probably, you know, I mean, I've watched Pulp Fiction, I could watch it over and over again. And, but I love Hateful Eight though. You know, I think it's an undersung Tarantino film. You know what I mean? It doesn't get much mention for some reason.
Don't know why.
But the moment it came out, I loved it. I bought it on DVD. I just think it's a great film.
Agreed.
But, you know, I love that. I love crime heist films. I just love Reservoir Dogs. It's just so, it's an MTV, you know, it's like that MTV era film. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And except it's a crime heist film, but it's just done so, the characters just alone, Mr. Pink, Mr. Orange, Mr. White, you know, like the dialogue in the beginning at the diner. It's
spectacular.
But it's golden. It's like, you know, so many references to Madonna, Charles Bronson, The Great Escape, all of that stuff.
Yep.
So many references. So much pop, oozing with pop culture.
I don't tip. Why don't you? Like, there's so much is happening in that moment, which is why also this film is so amazing, is he's a master of dialogue. He sucks you in, and the characters feel real, because it's like we've had these conversations, you know, like you have these conversations with your buddies and these things happen, and it's part of the ball busting of men talking with one another. And it's so realistic. It's so grounded.
Kevin Smith does the same thing.
Exactly. That's why these films are engrossing, because you're engrossed in what they're saying.
It's you talking with your buddies.
Yeah.
It's you talking with your buddies. That's
and then you're just going to go out and shoot some people and steal some diamonds. But it's like, after that, we're going to go get a Royale with cheese. Like, it's no big deal. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Pulp Fiction's definitely in my top three for sure. I don't think there's a thing that Tarantino has done that I haven't liked. I even love Four Rooms. I can't think of anything that he's done that I have disliked that, like, oh, that's a piece of shit. No.
And that's a wrap on this month's edition of Pulp Reflections. I would once again like to thank my special guest, Mr. Neil Damiano, film reviewer for the Top 10 Films website, for joining me today. I had an absolute blast discussing the world-building Pulp Fiction did to help create what we now know as the Tarantinoverse. Now you can find the links to all of Mr. Damiano's endeavors and his socials in our show notes. And as always, you can become a member of the Church of Tarantino by following us on all of our socials. Those links can be found in the show notes as well. Now, if you'd be so kind and take a moment to like, review, subscribe, and follow us, the church would greatly appreciate it, as it will help other fellow Tarantino fans like yourself find the show. So be sure to join me again in 2 weeks as Miss Jalen Salas-Solman, producer of the J-Days YouTube channel, joins me on our character study series as we take an in-depth look at the nose-powdering, twist contest-winning gangster's wife, Mia Wallace. So until then, I'm the Reverend Scott K. May Tarantino be with you always.
This has been a man with an exceptional beard production.